You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 49 of Tea Break Archaeology. My name is Matilda Siebrecht, and today I am savouring a blueberry and vanilla tea, which was a random purchase that I made the last time I bought from our local tea shop, and I'm very much appreciating it. It's very delicious. And joining me on my tea break today, again, she has joined me on a tea break before, but that was back when we were time traveling and now we're just having a regular old tea break, is textile archaeologist Ronja Lau. So welcome, Ronja. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for the invite, Matilda. I'm very pleased to be here again.
And are you also enjoying a beverage this fine morning?
Yeah, I'm those kind of people who is drinking only water and tea only when I'm sick. So if I drink tea, this is most of the time when I don't feel so good. Then, you know, I'm German and tea is super healthy and all of the herbish teas that there is.
It was so funny when I first moved to Germany and you go to the doctor and, you know, you've got a really sore throat or something and they say, yeah, have you tried peppermint tea, you know, or something? You go, they're very into their, yeah, the sort of herbal remedies here in Germany, which I enjoy. It's nice to not have to take medicine all the time. And it does work. That's the funny thing. So, okay, but that's fair. So if you're having a tea, it's probably like a herbal potion rather than
I think I have nettle teas here because nettle is obviously also good for your health. Don't ask me for what especially.
Maybe I have
it in my cupboard, so
I think we have a nettle tea as well. I'm pretty sure that my German husband has on stock just in case. I feel like I should get a German doctor on this podcast at some point to talk about the health benefits of tea. That's probably
perfect. Yeah,
there you go. I'll get a neurosurgeon in. We'll talk about the health benefits. But do you also, are you then a coffee drinker?
Occasionally. I drink also coffee when I don't feel good. For example, when I have a hangover, I tend to drink a coffee afterwards. Okay. So I feel a bit better.
I mean, well, indeed, you know, combine, go from one headache to another. That's definitely healthy then. Well, so what, how do you usually enjoy your breaks then? Do you just sort of take a moment, have a sip of water?
Yeah, I go usually when I'm in the office in the museum, I go and annoy my colleagues, which is basically a perfect break. You know, I go to their offices and ask like, what are you doing? Talk to me. Do you have a cookie? And then I annoy them a bit and then I go on with my work afterwards. How I spend my breaks.
Which is the perfect segue, actually. So indeed, the last time we spoke, I can't even remember where you were exactly the last time we spoke, but it was a while ago. It was a couple of years ago now. So you are now in a museum.
Yes, for the moment, actually. So anymore, but you caught me in the face where I'm working in a museum. Yes. Okay. Do you want to know in which one?
Well, you don't have to tell me, but I mean, we are on a podcast, so.
No, I'm currently working in the Keltenmuseum Hallein. It's the Celtic Museum in Hallein, which is situated in Austria, actually. So I'm in Austria at the moment.
Okay.
And it is close to Salzburg. Salzburg is also close to the German border, close to Bavaria. It's a very nice city. And the Celtic Museum in Hallein is the museum where all of the archaeological finds are exhibited, which were found in the Dürnberg. And the Dürnberg is a mountain, and there's a settlement and a big graveyard and also a salt mine.
Which sounds vaguely familiar. I feel like we may have mentioned a salt mine before. Okay. Oh, perfect. So it's the perfect location for your work, which is on the remains from the salt mines. Oh, excellent. Nice. So are you working there to do the research or are you working there kind of alongside your research?
Yeah, so it's now like a mixed situation at the moment. So I started working in the museum only for my PhD project to work on the archaeological finds there because they're stored in the museum and, you know, the best is you go there and work on the finds at the site. And then, of course, the museum thought, we are making a new exhibition for the prehistoric area. And we need lots of information and texts and also a bit of textile reconstructions. And so they hired me also for working on their new exhibition. And this is what I do at the moment. I will finish now all of the work for the new exhibition. And then I'm basically done here.
Oh, so, amazing. And so how long is the exhibition on for?
Yeah, so the old exhibition, like this is a permanent exhibition, and the old one was now 20 years old, you know, and is a bit out of date. And so they thought like, okay, we have to renew it. And they're going to renew the permanent exhibition, and it will hopefully be finished by autumn this year. Okay. So we don't know, of course, like construction sites and exhibitions, they always take a bit longer than they expect. And so the plan is, yeah, to have a new permanent exhibition for the museum.
Oh, lovely. Well, and speaking of outdated things and renewing stuff, we're just full of segues this episode. It's fantastic. So one of the things that you are sort of a specialist in, as we've kind of alluded to already, is textiles archaeology. And we talked a little bit about that before, but I think before when you came on, we were talking mainly about needles and that particular kind of archaeology. But in terms of sort of textile archaeology in general, I always, before I sort of chatted to you about it, I always assumed that was quite a new field, but apparently it has been going on for a little while. It's just kind of having a resurgence, shall we say.
Yeah, textile archaeology is a bit weird in how it's developed, basically. So the research history, basically also for Germany or Central Europe, is a bit wonky. So, for example, there was one pioneer in textile archaeologist. He was called Hans-Jürgen Hund. And he was active around the 60s and 70s. So quite early-ish, you know. Of course, the archaeological specialties were a bit older, of course, but, yes, you know, that's okay. And he did great work for his time. So, but he was alone, and of course, nobody else would contribute to that. And then somehow it crashed a bit again after his time. And then there was nothing else. And then it rose a bit, you know, in the, let's say, late 80s and 90s and early 2000s, mostly then also in Scandinavia, where all of the cool textiles were found, for example, in bogs or in those also like earlier in the Bronze Age oak coffins and stuff like that. Was always a bit up and down, you know, in the textile archaeology. And that's because also the reason maybe why we don't had so early standardized methods or typology or something like this. So everything like this actually evolved way later, like in the past, I would say 20 years only.
Oh, wow. So okay.
Textile ecology existed, so people knew there were some old
clothes. Yeah.
But we don't know what to do with them. Let's document them, you know, vastly, and then it's gone. Really investigating and creating a topic like also textile ecology, this is quite newish, I would say, like 20 years at least, since we have standards and methods and communicate with each other, and we're growing community, and I would say this is quite new.
That's very exciting then, to be part of that new entering in. So how did you get into the field? How did you start?
Yeah, I stumbled a bit in. No, I studied prehistoric archaeology in Berlin. So I'm from Berlin, and I studied there my bachelor and master's prehistoric archaeology. And of course, if you study archaeology, you have to somehow specialize on something. Like, you know, people do pottery, some people do bones, some people do stones, so whatever. And also already in my bachelor, I thought like, but I'm not interested.
I'm a rebel. I want to be something.
I want to do something which nobody does, and which
I'm
also
not like other girls.
Does not get taught at university, because this is the main problem. You know, textiles do not get taught in archaeology.
True, even now. Yeah.
Basically nothing. So I thought like, but this is a category. Why is nobody talking about it? I will sacrifice myself. I mean, my bachelor was very theoretical. And then for my master's, I thought like, okay, I had to, you know, I have to get my hands on objects, because this is how you work in archaeology, you know, you get objects. So I thought, okay, I'll find someone who will teach me how to do textile archaeology.
Nice.
Which is not a person in Berlin and probably also not in Germany. So I went to Austria to finish my master's. And I went to Vienna, and there I found, of course, Karina Grümmer. She's like a queen.
The goddess of textiles archaeology. Yeah.
she's the pope.
Yeah.
And there she taught me all of the textile archaeology methods she knew, and I could work on actual textiles, and I was blown away by the possibilities. I had no idea before because, like, yeah, I read the books, of course, and I read reports and, you know, perfectly fine. But this was the first time I got into real contact with textile archaeology. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh, which is so fascinating that it's such a, like, you've basically carved your own niche for yourself then within archaeological research. I mean, obviously it did exist because, as you said, textiles archaeology has existed technically since the sort of 1960s. But yeah, is it something then that you've seen even within your career, you know, relatively early research career, that it's already developing a lot more and it's already becoming a lot more standardized?
Yeah, for sure. So there's no finished standard yet. So we still have to figure out how to deal with objects in a specific way and with which methods are working the best. So it is still a work in progress, I would say. So my work at the moment is also like creating a base for future research. So this is nothing, you know, nothing high-end, specialized. I will only use the coolest methods. I don't know, funding money for...
funding money? What's that?
You know, like, people are so invested into, oh, this is the best topic ever. We already know this for many years. Like, no. I have to work quite hard to get accepted and to get audience listening. So creating the base now is still what I do. And but this is super cool to be part of this funding kind of group, basically.
Yeah, no, very cool. And I mean, yeah, the fact that you've stuck with it, even though it's difficult, even though you've had to, you know, it hasn't been easy, right? Like, it hasn't been one of those things that you just fall into. You have climbed that mountain to the textile archaeology. What do you find most exciting about it? Like, what still grips you today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, So the thing is, the textiles I work on, they're of course from a salt mine. Maybe we had mentioned
this. We'll talk about that after the break. Yeah, we should probably mention it briefly.
But they look amazingly well, you know, and the sheer understanding of my objects are 2,500 years old, but they look fresh and new and colorful. Amazing. And people actually made them and wore them on their skin, you know. I always say, like, no object in archaeology is closer to the human being than their clothing and the textiles. You know, you can hold tools in your hand, but you can put them away. You can, you know, work with them, but for a short amount of time. But the clothing is something which is part of yourself and part of your identity and about your culture and about where you live and where you come from. So this always strikes me when I think, like, was somebody wore this, maybe, you know? And I always get like shivers, that, like, goosebumps.
Definitely. No. And especially if you have it so well preserved, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. Has it also kind of changed the way that you look at textiles in the modern day? Like, the way that you sort of notice more what people are wearing and things like that?
Yeah, for sure. So I often talk about, like, recycling and how people used to handle their textiles in the past. And of course, human beings were a bit shitty all of the time. Yeah. So, of course, they also threw away stuff which they could have been used more often. But for the textiles, interestingly, they were recycling them quite well. So they were fixing holes, they were mending it, they were recycling them to other stuff. And, of course, they used wool and linen and everything that is biodegradable. And today, when I look at clothing and textiles in modern times, I changed a bit my perspective. Of course, I knew that, you know, there's a fast fashion and there's lots of clothing made out of plastic, basically. But working on those textiles and seeing, you know, we lost a bit of the habit of reusing and taking care of what we already have. This is something which I really enjoy at the moment. And I always try to tell people, you know, like, you know, you don't need to buy every season. It's new stuff. And also the quality is bad. And when I see clothing, I already can say, like, oh, this is bad quality. The fibers are only plastic. Why don't you buy cotton or linen or wool?
So I'm getting salt mine to preserve your clothes and you'll be fine. You won't never need to buy anything new again.
No, no. Also sometimes I think I get a bit annoying, like, so, oh, see you again. Like,
oh, man, talk about weave again.
But I think this is a great way to make people understand why archaeology is also important, because yes. we learn new things, you know, in quotes, new things, but they're not new. You yeah. know, people have done it before. So yeah. we just yeah. forgot. And now we're doing yeah. it again.
Exactly. And thanks to our efforts, which are going to be very well funded after this, for any funding bodies listening, we'll be able to learn again and we'll be able to get it better. Which, well, I think ponder that, listeners. We're going to have a very quick break to top up our tea, but we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I hope the teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So we teased people a little bit about this salt mine that you're working on and the kind of textiles that you're working on there. So perhaps you could give a kind of, I don't know, an elevator pitch. This is something that I remember from my PhD that you're always told. You have to have an elevator pitch for your PhD topic that you can very quickly tell people what it is you're doing. So what is your elevator pitch for your PhD?
Okay, yeah, I can start for sure. My PhD project is about textiles from an Iron Age salt mine. So the Iron Age salt mine is situated in Austria, in the Alps, basically, Alpine region. Mm-hmm. And it was used from 600 to 100 BC. So it's Iron Age, and we call it like the Celtic era. Uh-huh. People used to work in the salt mine to extract it and to trade the salt. And inside the salt mine, when they worked, they left lots of rubbish, basically.
All of this
stuff. Yay! Trash! And then, of course, yeah, like everything, you know, wooden objects, tools, and fibulas, and food, and feces, and also
wow.
text.
Okay.
Yeah, and yeah. because of the preservation in the salt, all of these objects, which are mostly organic, they preserved really well over the past 2,500 years. So they are
which is amazing, because usually they wouldn't, right? Like usually that stuff wouldn't survive.
They wouldn't. Yeah. If you find them in normal sediment, in settlements or graveyards, they would have not been preserved. So this is a very unique find spot. There are only two of these find spots in Europe, which is the other one's Hallstatt, and mine is the Dürnberg salt mine. So, which makes it unique anyway, and also hard to compare because there are only two. And from these textiles, which are mostly also from the Iron Age, like I said, I investigated all of them from the past 35 years of excavation. So excavations have been going on, and the textiles were extracted and found and put into the museum, and now I investigated all of them, and there are over 689 textile complexes, which means that there are over 2,000 fragments of textiles. But of course, sometimes they belong together, so it's like a puzzle. And this is what I work at for my PhD.
Oh gosh, amazing. And I mean, well done. Excellent. Ding, we're here. And I mean, that's quite a specific topic. Was it just because of the preservation that like sort of drew you to this particular site, or was it that there's not that many with textiles? Was it that you were really fascinated by salt? What was it that sort of drew you to?
Yeah, I'm a salty girl for sure. But no, after I finished my master's in Vienna and I was in close contact with Karina Grömer there, we were thinking about, you know, what is the next step? That's always an academia. You know, you finish one thing, you think about what's the next step? You know, what other project can I sell my salt to? And she was then telling me, well, you know, I did Hallstatt, but, you know, there's another salt mine. It's called Dürnberg. Maybe you have heard of it. And someone needs to work on those textiles. And I said, okay. I mean, yeah. And she was like, well, there are, of course, not many people, but also I'm now well equipped with my skills that I could do that. And so we got in contact with the university which is excavating there, which is actually not an Austrian university, but a German university. It's the Ruhr University in Bochum. And Bochum University is famous because it is a mining archaeology faculty. So they're dealing with mining. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's very niche.
That is also very niche, you know, textiles and mining and everything.
Yeah, my goodness. Okay.
Yeah, for sure. And they're dealing also with copper mining and stuff like this, but also with salt mining. And they are working on the salt mine now for many years. And so that's why I'm a PhD student in Bochum and Vienna.
Okay,
that's
nice.
That's why I'm a bit split personality. I have the mining part and I have the textile part. So, and that's, I said, of course, yes to the project because, yeah, I wanted to take the opportunity to have like one of the best preserving conditions for textiles ever. And I want to have the amount of data and the huge amount of textiles there are, because usually there are not that many when you find them occasionally. So this was the opportunity per se to say, okay, yes, I have to do that for sure.
And I mean, what do you actually, because you're saying that you're documenting them or you're analyzing them. So I mean, what is it actually that you are documenting or analyzing? Are there like multiple different levels? Is it just sort of a typology, a catalog, lots of pictures?
Yes, all of them.
Yeah, great.
Well, of course, you start with just plain documenting the textile. So of course, photography, I have to take photos. So I'm doing photography on the textiles for sure. But the main thing is that I microscope them, because under the microscope, I can see how the textile is really made. And I extract a lot of information from it. So under the microscope, I can see the structure of the threads, for example, how, in which direction are they twisted? Are they twisted quite firmly or quite loosely? Are they made out of wool or linen or anything other? Are they very densely woven or are they a bit loosened? Do they have holes or weaving folds? So everything I can see on that textile, I will document, like the smallest things.
Yeah.
And then with the data I extracted, like I have a huge database now, I can evaluate, for example, what is the most common quality in the textiles, or what is the most common twist direction, or what is the most common pattern or the color or whatever. So I can make like a really nice evaluation afterwards. Okay. And then, of course, is the part of the natural analysis, which you can do quite a lot on the textiles because the preservation is really good. Everything that is organic is, for example, suitable for C14 dating. So you can date the textile.
Right. See how old it is.
Okay. How old it is. So we will do that. Or you can make color analysis or dye stuff analysis to see what is the plant which was used for dyeing the textiles.
And amazing.
Actually, yesterday I sent the samples to Brussels. So I will wait now. To see and wait for the results. So this is also possible. And what is also possible is you can have isotope analysis. And isotope analysis, we mostly do to see where are the resources from. So the material we have is mostly wool and linen. Mm-hmm. And with strontium, for example, or oxygen or carbon isotopes, you can investigate, for example, where were those sheep from? You know, were they from a local area or from somewhere else? Or where do the flax fields where, you know, like were they in the valley or were they somewhere else? Because the site we are talking about is on top of a mountain. So there are no fields, you know, there are no plain areas. So people had to somehow get their resources from somewhere else. So these methods are used to answer, of course, questions about trade network, about resources, about textile quality, and also about typology and chronology in the salt mine. The textiles can have a good insight on how things developed over the 500 years the site was in use, and also to compare it to Hallstatt, because Hallstatt, the salt mine, is a bit older and Dürnberg is a bit younger. So you can really see the change of identity, culture, and people through the textiles in the past 1,000 years, because you have it from the Bronze Age in Hallstatt and you have it to the Middle Iron Age in Dürnberg. And this is like really unique situation which we have here. And the typology will be, of course, one of the biggest parts as a result from my PhD.
And I mean, well, so I've been going, because I too am a materials girly. So I am, you know, always amazed at how much information we can find out. But I do have to ask that horrendous question that we always get as archaeologists, as material culture archaeologists. well, sure, you have all that data, but why do we need to know all this stuff? Why is it important to do this research?
No.
Okay. I'm preparing you for your defense.
No, for sure. So, of course, like I said, textile archaeology is quite newish in the field, and we still have to find out what can we say, or what is the data saying to us, you know? Yeah. Like, we are finding this out in the past 10 years at the moment. Yeah, so we have now clues that, for example, the textile quality or the weave types, you know, like there are different weave types and patterns and colors, that they all have a cultural meaning, for example, for the people in the past. And of course, in archaeology, we always try to separate different cultures. So this is like, for example, the Eastern Hallstatt culture, this is the Western Hallstatt culture, and we can see this because of weapons and the shape of fibulas and the pottery they used. So we always try to, you know, distinguish different areas, different people, different cultures because of their material culture, right?
Yeah.
And this is also possible with the textiles. But the thing is, this is quite the new topic, so we don't know yet for sure how to connect the dots of people, for example, in Dürnberg used tabby, so plain woven textiles, most of the time. So people there, you know, are the tabby people.
But maybe the people, tabby cats.
Maybe the people in Bavaria, which were also Celts, maybe they used another kind of weave type, and maybe you have to separate them somehow. Maybe we connect them. So this is also quite in the state of the moment research we're going to try to investigate. How can we differentiate or combine different cultures and regions with our data? And what does it say about us? What does it mean? Of course, the meaning of colors and patterns we can never know because there are no written sources. We can only guess, like, what's maybe, you know, in fashion or what's the influence maybe from other regions. But also this would be nice, you know, having influence from other regions, knowing where did the materials come from, the dye stuff, the contact with the Mediterranean, for example, you know, to investigate this and not only seeing this in other materials, for example, in bronze or gold or amber, but also in textiles. And you can see that. And this is new information. And I think people would love to hear that all of this is possible. And this is very important in all the archaeology.
Yeah. So it's kind of adding like an extra aspect of the toolkit to be able to sort of prove things and investigate things, that kind of stuff. And then, of course, if you have more information about the past, then you have more information about the present and the future. And archaeology is relevant, people. Please give us more funding. But no, that's really interesting. And I mean, you mentioned already, I guess we can just briefly discuss, so the Hallstatt is the main salt mine. And I mean, I'd heard of that one as well. I mean, the Hallstatt culture is one of the big ones from sort of prehistory as well. How does this mine link with that one? Are they similar culture? You mentioned that one's earlier than the other. Is it sort of progression or how does that link?
Yeah. So for people who don't know also where exactly we are, I just briefly tell you that Hallstatt also lays in Austria for sure. And they are like how the crow flies. They are 40 kilometers apart. So they're really close.
Yeah.
Yeah, really close. So, you know, this is really important information.
Yeah.
And Hallstatt was used since the Bronze Age to the early Iron Age. And the problem was mainly, we think now, it did not work out quite well in Hallstatt because it is situated also on top of a mountain next to a lake. And really, it is hard to get out of this mountainous area for trading. You know, this is really hard. And there were also some catastrophes. So, yeah, galleries were collapsing and the mountain was really bitchy, actually, so probably there were a lot of casualties.
I've never heard of a mountain being described as bitchy. God, what a bitchy mountain.
They are always moving, so this is the problem here in the mountains, that they're always moving and changing, and this makes it very dangerous, of course. And so people may thought like, okay, we have to change the location, you know. So they probably then went to another location, which is then probably Dürnberg, and started working there because there it is easier also to trade the salt because there's a valley right under it with a river and you can use the river for transportation, which is super nice.
Yeah.
It is not that steep and not that high in the mountain, so everything seemed a lot easier. So we can see like an exchange also from Hallstatt and Dürrenberg, because they were used a few hundred years parallel, like from maybe 600 to 500 or 400 BC, they were used simultaneously, basically. So, which is super interesting, because also like this is, like I said, it's a unique situation. And Hallstatt always, of course, it is said, because a whole archaeological period was named after Hallstatt, also because the graveyard is super important in our field, of course. But Dürrenberg is just as important for the later Iron Age. Mm-hmm. But there is no period called Dürrenberg
period.
There's nothing period, which is called after a place in Switzerland. Because they could not name two Iron Age periods after two Austrians.
Yeah, fair. I mean, we don't want monopoly in the period.
No, for sure.
Archaeologicals.
But of course, people also in metals, for example, they know that Dürrenberg is very important because of the weapons and the jewelry and everything they also found in the graveyards. And so it is like a brother-sister kind of situation we have with the salt mines. Of course, in Hallstatt, there are also lots of textiles from two different periods, Bronze and Iron Age.
Oh, wow.
And from Dürrenberg, only from one period, which is only Iron Age. We say Hallstatt D to Latin, maybe C or a bit of D, maybe, but then it's already over. But the thing is, in Dürrenberg, I have more textiles than in Hallstatt. So I talked about this also with Karina.
I was about to say, did you tell Karina this? Did she go?
Yeah.
I gave her the wrong site.
We have like a friendly fight always with each other. Like, I have more textiles. And Karina's like, yeah, but mine are older.
Mine are interesting.
So it's totally fine, of course. And we also question why we have so many more textiles in Dürrenberg than in Hallstatt. And but that's totally fine. It's the very cool situation that we compare the textiles and see really what happened in the same region in Austria over a couple of hundred years. So that's really cool.
Amazing. Well, we're going to talk about this more, but I think we're kind of running to the end of our particular tea break, or water break in your case. But don't worry, everyone, there will be another tea break coming up in 2 weeks' time, where I will be chatting further with Ronja all about her research at the Dürrenberg mines and all about archaeological textiles. I hope that you enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please do like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeological content, including four episodes that have featured Ronja Lau. I'll make sure to link them in the show notes, as well as any other contact information or links to anything that we've been discussing today. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.